And a happy birthday today to Francis Berneman from Mason City, to Rebecca Barrio Nuevo from Cedar Falls, to Linda Weber from Grettinger, Leonard Thunderhorse from Newell, and Frank Strong Jr. from Des Moines. And you are joined today in your birthdays by actors Craig T. Nelson, who turns 80, Christine Lottie, who turns 74, and Robert Downey Jr., Iron Man himself, who turns 59 today. Happy birthday to all of you. And we have an additional special announcement for you today. Iris has a limited number of free tickets to the Sunday, April 14, 2 p.m. performance of Beautiful, the Carole King musical, with live audio description at the Des Moines Community Playhouse. Beautiful tells the story of the early life and career of Carole King, weaving a tapestry with songs that she wrote throughout. Did you get that reference to her most famous album, Tapestry? If you are interested in this special event, please call the Iris office at 515-243-6833. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you are hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you are not a registered IRIS listener, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so we can get you on our list. We need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. And now here's Linda with our obituaries.
From Des Moines, Carole K. Major passed away March 30th at Luther Park Trinity Center in Des Moines. Kay was born August 2, 1938, in Holstein, Iowa, to Wendell H. Conover and Marion H. Moons Conover. Kay is survived by her sisters, Dorothy Johnston of Waukania, Minnesota, and Catherine Grell, whose partner is Dennis, in Altoona. Her sister-in-law, Marie Conover of Lincoln, Nebraska, and her brother, Marion Conover, partner Bonnie of Adel, and numerous nieces and nephews. Kay was preceded in death by her parents, her husband, Bill V. Major, and her sister, Shirley Rickard, and brother, Wendell D. Conover. After graduating from Holstein High School, Kay attended Morningside College in Sioux City, where she received her BA degree in teaching. Kay also received a Master of Science in Education degree from Drake University. Kay taught 35 years in the Des Moines Public School District to 4th, 5th, and 6th graders in regular classrooms and within self-contained classrooms, teaching academically talented students. She served as assistant principal for part of her career. Kay ended her career teaching fourth graders at Des Moines Jefferson Elementary's traditional school. Following retirement, Kay worked part-time at the Urbandale Library for several years. Kay met Bill in Des Moines and they were married on July 23, 1961, in the Little Brown Church of in the Vale in Nashua, Iowa. They resided in Urbandale their entire lives. Kay was especially interested in raising and showing Dandy Dinmont Terriers, of which she received championships on four dogs. After her dog showing career, Kay and Bill graduated to rescue dogs of any breed and provided them with a loving home. Kay and Bill also hosted foreign exchange students, 8 in total, from Germany, Italy, France, Turkey, and Hungary. They enjoyed providing each student with a loving home and a year of education at Urbandale High School. The family will have a private interment at a later date. You may honor Kay's memory by making a donation to the Animal Rescue League of Des Moines. And from Grimes, Mary Jean Bennett, 73, passed away peacefully on April 1st at home under hospice care. Family will greet friends from 5 to 7 p.m. on Friday, April 5th at Hamilton's near Highland Memory Gardens on Northwest 60th Avenue in Des Moines. Mass of Christian burial will take place the following day, Saturday, April 6th, at 10 a.m. at All Saints Catholic Church on 52nd, Northeast 52nd Avenue in Des Moines, with burial to follow at Highland Memory Garden Cemetery in Des Moines. You can visit hamiltonsfuneralhome.com for a full obituary and to leave a condolence.
And we will return now to the front page section of the Register with this story. The Iowa House okays literacy bill with guidelines on how to teach reading. Iowa House lawmakers have passed a bill that would require aspiring teachers to take a new assessment aimed at teaching literacy and require schools to provide students with a personalized plan if they are not reading at grade level. House lawmakers voted 92-3 Tuesday to pass House File 2618, sending it to the Senate for consideration. Governor Kim Reynolds proposed a version of the legislation in her Condition of the State address on January, kickstarting the conversation. The bill requires students in Iowa's Teacher Preparation Program to take the Foundations of Reading assessment developed by Massachusetts. The results would be reported to the Iowa Department of Education. The curriculum is used by 13 states, according to Pearson's website, which describes the assessment as aligned with scientifically based reading research for early childhood education, elementary education, middle childhood education, and special education teacher licensure candidates. That's the end of the quote from the description. Reynolds' original proposal would have required aspiring Iowa teachers to pass the test to graduate from their teacher preparation program and receive their licensure. The House bill removes the requirement that potential teachers pass the test or that it be used as a criteria for graduation. Representative Tom Moore, a Republican of Griswold, the bill's House floor manager and a retired teacher, described the new version of the legislation as toned down from Reynolds' proposal. I also want to thank the governor's office for their willingness to accept my toning down what the original bill was and to come up with what I feel is a good compromise and allowing those teaching institutions to be able to administer a test but not have it be tied to their licensure or their graduation, he said. Schools would be required to notify parents and guardians of children in kindergarten through sixth grade if their student is not reading proficient at grade level. The notice to parents would inform them that they can request that their student be held back at the current grade level if they are not reading proficiently. Any students from kindergarten through sixth grade who are not reading at grade level would be given a personalized plan until their reading improves. Representative Sharon Steckman, a Democrat of Mason City, a retired teacher, said she appreciates how the bill was changed from the original proposal. She said teachers are already doing much of what is laid out in the bill. Teachers watch out for kids that are not reading at grade level already. Teachers talk to parents already. Teachers put forth an individualized education program or some sort of a plan for that student to get on grade level already, she said. So much of this we are already doing. Moore said he believes it's still important for the state to require that K through 6 students be given personalized reading plans if they are not reading proficiently. Obviously, we wouldn't be in the middle of the pack nationally reading-wise if all our teachers were doing some of these things, he said. Senate Republicans have put forward their own bill that takes a different approach to teaching literacy.
Senate okays amendment requiring flat income tax rate. Two legislative votes needed before going on ballot. The Iowa Senate has approved a constitutional amendment that would require Iowa to have a flat individual income tax rate if the state imposes an income tax at all. The Senate voted 34-15 Tuesday to pass Senate Joint Resolution 2004, with every Republican in favor and every Democrat opposed. The proposal would require an individual income tax imposed by the state to be a single rate. It would forbid having a graduated income tax system with multiple rates based on income level. If the proposed amendment passes the House this year, lawmakers would have to pass the measure again in 2025 or 2026. It would then be placed on a statewide general election ballot and would require majority approval to be added to the Constitution. Governor Kim Reynolds signed a law in 2022 that will take Iowa to a flat income tax rate of 3.9% by 2026. The law is still in the process of phasing in. The state's top rate this year is 5.7% and will drop to 4.82% next year unless lawmakers make further changes. Senator Jason Schultz, Republican of Schleswig, said it's appropriate to allow Iowans to decide whether they want to effectively make the policy permanent by adding it to the Constitution. If you want this for the rest of Iowa's future, ladies and gentlemen of Iowa, here it is, he said. You get to vote for this. You get to put this in the Iowa Constitution for perpetuity. Senator Cindy Winkler, Democrat of Davenport, criticized Republicans for rushing to put a flat tax rate in the Iowa Constitution while the state is still phasing in the cuts. She said doing so could harm the state's ability to fund government programs in the future. Taxes are not necessarily things that people want to pay, she said, but services are what they expect to receive, and that balance is important. We have a responsibility, and that responsibility rests with the government and rests with the legislature. Reynolds and Republican lawmakers have proposed speeding up how quickly the flat tax phases in and are considering lowering the rate further. Reynolds proposed lowering the rate to 3.65% for 2024 and 3.5% in 2025 and beyond. The chairs of the House and Senate Ways and Means Committees are negotiating their own tax plan. Republicans are also separately considering another proposed constitutional amendment this year that would require a two-thirds vote of the Iowa legislature to raise taxes in the future. That measure, House Joint Resolution 2006, has passed the House but has yet to be taken up by the Senate.
The Senate confirms Mackenzie Snow as an education chief, although Democrats criticize her lack of experience. The Iowa State Senate has voted to confirm Mackenzie Snow as director of Iowa Department of Education, installing Governor Kim Reynolds' pick to lead the agency over objections from Democrats. Snow's confirmation comes days after Reynolds signed a wide-ranging law overhauling Iowa's area education agencies and giving the state more oversight over special education programs with the creation of a new division of special education. The Senate voted 34-15 to confirm Snow, with every Republican in favor and every Democrat opposed. Nominees require the support of two-thirds of the Senate or 34 votes to be confirmed. Reynolds used her remarks while signing the AEA overhaul into law as an opportunity to praise Snow, saying she is so excited about the future of education with you at the helm. Director Snow, you are going to be a tremendous leader, Reynolds said, leading the invited guests at the ceremony in a round of applause. Democrats on Tuesday criticized Snow for her lack of experience, saying she has never held a teaching license in the United States. Director Snow is not eligible to be hired for the educational positions in our school districts, said Senator Molly Donahue, a Democrat of Cedar Rapids, a teacher. She is not eligible to be hired for a position at an AEA that she will be overseeing. She cannot be a principal. She cannot be a superintendent. She cannot be a chief executive officer of the AEA with her qualifications, said Donahue. Senator Jeff Taylor, a Republican of Sioux Center, said if the legislature had wanted to require teaching experience or a teacher license as a requirement to hold the position, they would have said so, he said. We heard a few minutes ago a listing of different roles, teacher, principal, superintendent, AEA administrator, and it was stated that Mackenzie Snow does not qualify for any of those roles, he said. That may be, but she's not applying for any of those, he said. Snow started on the job last June, becoming Iowa's third Department of Education director in a year. She succeeded Chad Aldous, who suddenly resigned 4 months after replacing Ann Lebo for what he called family reasons. She took the reins of the department as Iowa began implementing a new program providing families with taxpayer-funded education savings accounts to pay private school costs. Lawmakers have also passed a range of other education-related laws, including a 2023 measure that restricts teaching about sexual orientation and gender identity in kindergarten through sixth grade and requiring schools to remove books with sex acts. Those provisions are currently blocked in court as a legal challenge is decided. Snow has previously worked at state education departments in New Hampshire and Virginia, where she served as the deputy director, as well as for the Foundation for Excellence in Education, a think tank founded by Republican Jeb Bush. She worked in the U.S. Department of Education under the Trump administration, spearheading a program that would have created tax credits for those who donate to organizations providing private school scholarships. She holds a bachelor's degree in political science and no advanced degrees. She has taught remedial courses at the University of the Free State of South Africa. Donahue said Snow has talents when it comes to education policy, but said that's a different skill set than the one needed to lead the Department of Education. Our education system does not need policy innovators, but experienced educational leaders who can relate to, understand, and directly address the needs of our teachers and our students, she said. Republicans said Democrats' criticism of Snow comes from their opposition to the education policies that Reynolds and the legislative Republicans have passed. Let's look at the bottom line here, said Senator Brad Zahn, a Republican of Urbandale. The reason why her name is up there and why you're all upset about her is because of what we've done for education reform and what we've done to allow our parents to decide what is the best educational opportunity is, he said. Senators also voted 48-1 to reconfirm Kelly Garcia as the director of Department of Health and Human Services. Reynolds originally appointed Garcia in 2019 as director of the Department of Human Services. She was confirmed unanimously by the Senate in 2020 and has since overseen a merger of the Iowa Department of Public Health to create the new HHS department. Last year, HHS absorbed more government agencies as part of a government reorganization plan Reynolds signed into law. Garcia is in the process of shepherding through a reorganization of Iowa's mental health and substance abuse regions into a new behavioral health system. Lawmakers are expected to send a bill with the changes to Reynolds soon. Senator Herman Quirbach, a Democrat of Ames, cast the lone vote against Garcia's confirmation. The Senate also confirmed other members of Reynolds' cabinet. The Senate voted Tuesday to confirm or reconfirm several other members of Reynolds' cabinet and other appointees for new terms and their roles. These votes included James Johnson as the superintendent of banking. The vote was 49-0. Beth Skinner as director of the Department of Corrections, 46-3. Gregory Somoryowski as CEO of the Iowa Public Employees Retirement System, 49-0. Dustin Graber to the State Judicial Nominating Commission, 49-0. Carolyn Reese Schulte as chair of the Iowa Board of Parole, 49-0. Catherine Lucas as a member of the Public Employment and Relations Board, 35-14. Scott Marler as director of the Department of Transportation, 49-0. Douglas Hoisington to the Iowa Board of Medicine, 35-15. And Emily Wharton as director of the Department for the Blind, 49-0.
Israel facing backlash in aid workers' deaths. The WCK founder says workers were targeted systematically, car by car. Family members and government leaders of the 7 World Central Kitchen members killed in an Israeli missile strike were pressing Israel for answers Wednesday as details of the attack began to emerge. World Central Kitchen founder Jose Andres said the workers were targeted systematically, car by car, and that the charity group had clear communication with the Israeli military, which knew the aid workers' movements. This is not just a bad luck situation where, oops, we dropped the bomb in the wrong place, Andres told Reuters Wednesday. Even if we were not in coordination with the Israel military, no democratic country and no military can be targeting civilians and humanitarians. The seven were killed Monday while traveling in a convoy from an aid warehouse in central Gaza. They were identified as Jacob Flinginger, 33, a dual U.S.-Canada citizen, Palestinian Saifuddin Islam Ayad Abdu'l-Haha, 25, Lezamwe Zomi Frankcom, 43, of Australia, Damian Sobol, 35, of Poland, and British nationals John Chapman, 57, James Jim Henderson, 33, and James Kirby, 47. These are the heroes of World Central Kitchen, the organization's CEO, Aaron Gore, said in a statement. Their smiles, laughter, and voices are forever embedded in our memories, and we have countless memories of them giving their best selves to the world. We are reeling from our loss, the world's loss. The bodies of six of the aid workers were transferred from Gaza across the Egyptian border to allow delegations from their home countries to receive them. The seventh victim, Abu Taha, was buried Tuesday in his hometown of Rafah. Frankcom is being remembered fondly in New York for her cooking and delivering meals with Somos Community Care in 2020 during the COVID-19 pandemic. Dr. Ramon Talai, founder and chairman of Somos Community Care, told CBS News. People were dying and she was preparing the food, Talai said. She was really a person that you could rely in difficult times. Some people say she was an angel. Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said Frankcom had previously volunteered during Australian brushfires and Monday had been providing aid to people who are suffering tremendous deprivation in Gaza. Albanese said he spoke with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu by phone Wednesday. I emphasize the importance of full accountability and transparency, Albanese said. Prime Minister Netanyahu has committed to full transparency about how this tragedy could possibly have occurred. Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk said the vast majority of Poles showed full solidarity with Israel after the Hamas attack, but warned Israel that you are putting this solidarity to a really hard test. The tragic attack on volunteers and your reaction arouse understandable anger. President Joe Biden will speak by phone with Netanyahu on Thursday, a U.S. official said. The White House has described Biden as outraged and heartbroken by the attack, but the president has made no fundamental change in the United States' steadfast support for Israel in its conflict in Gaza. National Security Communications Advisor John Kirby said Wednesday the White House will wait to see the results of Israel's investigation into the seven WCK deaths before it considers taking action in response. Israel has already admitted that it conducted and is at fault for the strike that killed the workers, Kirby told reporters. I think we need to let them finish that work and speak to it themselves, he continued. We need to see what they learn, and we need to see, just as importantly, what they do about what they learn, what changes they're willing to make, what accountability they're willing to observe. We're just not there yet. A senior Israeli official told the Times of Israel that a culture has developed across much of the Israeli military that has soldiers shooting first and asking questions later. The Israeli official, speaking on condition of anonymity, said the culture was also evident in December when three Israeli hostages escaped their Hamas-led militant guards and were waving a white flag when they were fatally shot by the friendly fire of Israeli troops. The December incident and Monday's tragedy were counter to the military rules of engagement, the official said, adding that Israeli soldiers are operating under immense pressure and difficult conditions. The Israeli army said it had begun calling up ultra-Orthodox religious students. Such students have been exempt from the draft since the country's founding in 1948. The decision to start drafting them had sparked protests across the nation, although many Israelis believe the decision was long overdue. Meanwhile, Israel War Cabinet member Benny Gantz on Wednesday called for national elections in September as Netanyahu's government faces pressure at home and abroad over the war in Gaza. "We must agree on a date for elections in September, towards a year to the war, if you will," Gantz said in a televised briefing. "Setting such a date will allow us to continue the military effort while signaling to the citizens of Israel that we will soon renew their trust in us." Netanyahu, Israel's longest-serving prime minister, has repeatedly ruled out early elections, which opinion polls suggest he would lose, saying that to go to the polls in the middle of a war would only reward Hamas. Biden faces immense pressure from young, progressive, and Arab American voters as he remains steadfast in his support of Israel following the October 7th Hamas attack that killed 1,200 people. More than 32,000 Palestinians have been killed in Israel's ensuing war in Gaza, according to the Gaza Health Ministry. The White House has increasingly been at odds with Netanyahu over his efforts to get humanitarian aid into Gaza and his planned military operation in Rafah in southern Gaza.
A storm system unleashes tornadoes and snow across the U.S. A major storm system threatened the Southeast and New England Wednesday, with more than 200,000 households in West Virginia, Kentucky, Ohio, Michigan, and Wisconsin remaining without power after Tuesday's messy weather, according to a database maintained by USA Today. On Tuesday, a confirmed tornado uprooted trees and damaged homes in an Atlanta suburb. There were reports of possible tornadoes in Alabama, West Virginia, Tennessee, Illinois, and Kentucky, where a family of five was rescued after being trapped under an overturned mobile home, according to WFIE-TV. The severe weather caused at least one death. KJRH-TV reported that a 46-year-old unhoused woman in Tulsa, Oklahoma, died after seeking shelter in a storm drain. As residents in the Ohio Valley cleaned up, millions of people in the upper Midwest and eastern United States braced for possible severe weather, with the Florida Panhandle and southern Georgia under a tornado watch and heavy snow forecast across parts of the upper Mississippi Valley and upper Great Lakes. The storm system was expected to move over the mid-Atlantic coast by Thursday evening and northeastward to the Gulf of Maine by Friday, according to the Weather Service. Forecasters anticipated more than 1 to 2 feet of snow in parts of New England by late Thursday. Conditions in the southeast and the mid-Atlantic are expected to subside by Friday. Wednesday's storms fell on the 50th anniversary of the 1974 tornado super outbreak, which wreaked havoc in the eastern United States, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, killing 335 people. The NOAA said the 1974 disaster served as the catalyst for a major overhaul of the National Weather Service, spurring modernization of the agency's observational technology. Megan Faria of Prospect, Kentucky, just outside Louisville, was on the phone with her husband as he drove home from work Tuesday while she watched the storm approach through a window. "Then I saw all of our flowers that we had hanging on the back were gone. I was like, I should head to the basement now," Faria told the Courier-Journal, part of the USA Today network, as she cleared fallen trees from her yard. Her house narrowly missed big damage. Her parents' home down the street was hit by a falling tree. No one was hurt, though. A positive conclusion after a tense ride home for her husband. A tornado has not yet been confirmed by the National Weather Service of Louisville. Louisville Mayor Craig Greenberg said the storm, with an impact consistent with the tornado, hit three subdivisions. Other areas affected by the storm include Anderson and Nelson counties, where Governor Andy Beshear confirmed that tornadoes touched down, along with in southern Indiana. And that's it for our shift for the last 90 minutes. Your readers have been Linda Lundgren and me, Twyla Glenn. It has been our very great pleasure to read for you. Now we'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Teresa Whitaker and Dorothy Hockenberg. We'll continue with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. And here's Dorothy with our next article.
Okay, we'll start with the opinion page from the Des Moines Register. Repeal of gender balance law is long overdue. This is a Your Turn opinion, and the authors are Jeffrey Jennings and Killeen Lindgren. Jeffrey is an attorney and Killeen is a legal policy manager at Pacific Legal Foundation, a public interest law firm that defends Americans' liberty against government overreach and abuse free of charge. Wednesday's repeal of Iowa's gender quota laws is a significant win for equality under the law. Since the 1980s, Iowa's state government has discriminated against both male and female Iowans aspiring to serve on public boards. State law required that boards, commissions, and councils, even local government, be balanced with an equal number of men and women, which means there is a 50-50 gender quota across Iowa government. By signing Senate File 2096 into law, Governor Kim Reynolds has brought this un-American legacy to an end. This repeal is long overdue, and harm has been done for decades. Last year, Iowa's Boards and Commissions Review Committee reported that the gender balance requirement results in, quote, nearly half of Iowa's population, end quote, being systematically excluded from consideration for appointment. The review committee also noted that excluding applicants based on their gender is not based on merit. That means jurisdictions across the state were forced to choose based on gender, even where someone more qualified for the role was available. And the laws have made it difficult for governments to fill the seats on commissions and councils. To make matters worse, gender quotas are blatantly unconstitutional. Just this January, a federal court struck down the Iowa law that required gender balancing on the state's judicial nominating commission, recognizing that gender quotas and gender balancing violate the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause. Iowans have Charles Hurley to thank for that court victory. Charles is a devoted father and grandfather who spent the past 40 years as an attorney, public representative, and active church member. As a state representative, Charles served on Iowa's House Judiciary Committee. His experience made him an excellent candidate for the State Judicial Nominating Commission. Unfortunately for Charles, Iowa law excluded him from appearing on the ballot in his district solely because of his gender. But Charles fought back with the help of our firm, Pacific Legal Foundation. In its attempt to justify the gender quota, the state argued that it was, quote, appropriately enacted to address the absolute absence of women, end quote, on the commission. The court rejected that rationale. It said that the alleged lack of women on the commission in the 1980s, when the law was first passed, cannot justify discrimination against men and women today. Thanks to Senate File 2096, sponsor Senator Jason Schultz, the Iowa legislature acted promptly to eliminate gender discrimination statewide for those who wish to serve on public boards and commissions. While Iowa has done the right thing, our work at Pacific Legal Foundation is not done. As our report explains, several other states employ sex-based requirements for service on various public boards and commissions. We won't stop fighting until all states are discrimination-free. Iowa has shown it can be done, and we hope that those states will soon follow Iowa's leadership in repealing their sex-based requirements for public service. Again, the article was by Jeffrey Jennings and Killeen Lindgren.
And our next opinion editor column is by Lucas Grunmeier. He is the opinion editor, excuse me. His column is, "As Cyclones fan, I can't bring myself to despise Clark. Caitlin Clark just keeps accumulating scoring records, TV ratings, pop culture ubiquity, and victories. Many of her achievements make me smile, momentarily, then I grimace. I've been trying for a while to untangle what college sports rivalry, the Cy-Hawk rivalry between Iowa State and Iowa here, means when it comes to assessing Clark. Does a rising tide lift all boats, or is it closer to zero-sum game with Clark's ascendance permanently ending any debate about the best women's basketball program in the state? If it's the latter, I want to despise Clark because she's hurt Iowa State, which I've supported all my life, through her ability and celebrity. After all, that's what sports rivals do, right? Villainize their opponents, especially the most successful ones. Invest emotionally in their failure so that it's all the more satisfying when, if they finally fall short in some way. The best program question was on my mind many years before Clark moved to Iowa City, as women's basketball is, narrowly, the Cyclone sport I've been most invested in since attending Iowa State from 2001 to 2005. Only once in 10 years, working nights and weekends, did I lose my professional composure, and it was during a women's basketball game, late on March 28, 2009, with Iowa State uncorking an unlikely last-minute rally in the Sweet 16 of the NCAA tournament. Michigan State, leading by 2 points and trying to advance against Iowa State's press, overthrew a cross-court pass that appeared on our tiny register copy desk television to sail over the fingertips of players from both teams. Leaping to my feet, I shouted, "It should be our ball!" It was. We won. Bill Fennelly has been Iowa State's head coach since 1995. Lisa Bluter, Iowa's, since 2000. Until the past few years, they coached their schools to remarkably even resumes. Iowa State had marginally more success in the NCAA tournament, reaching the Elite Eight a couple of times. Each school won some conference tournaments. When they faced each other, the home team won 10 times in a row. They competed for recruits, including one Caitlin Clark of West Des Moines Dowling Catholic, whose three finalists were Notre Dame, Iowa State, and Iowa. You could construct decent arguments that either was slightly more impressive, but the truth was that both were strong but not dominant programs that were fun to watch and cheer. Clark has altered the balance decidedly, even while Iowa State has had some excellent teams. The trouble started quickly in Clark's fifth game as a Hawkeye. Iowa State led 73-56 as the fourth quarter began. The final, Iowa 82, Iowa State 80, behind Clark's 34 points and game-winning three-pointer. But a big shot or a big game is normal. Clark has far surpassed that as a transcendent figure in Hawkeye history, in college, women's basketball history. In college basketball, she is, by a large margin, the preeminent character in March Madness this year, her fame consigning to margins exhilarating NCAA tournament feats like Audie Crook's 40-point effort in a comeback Cyclone win or the men's basketball team's run to the Sweet 16. Despite the Cyclones' encouraging success with a young team this year, I've still been fretting over the in-state situation. I was 15 years old before I could say I'd been alive for a Cyclone win over Iowa in football, so I have some sense of how dissatisfying a long run of Hawkeye dominance can be. Iowa is pulling in top recruit after top recruit to keep its program humming after Clark leaves for the pros this spring. The Cyclones haven't won in Carver Hawkeye Arena in 18 years. Casual fans tout the staggering attendance totals for Clark's games this season with little interest for the 9,000-plus fans per game Iowa State has averaged over 23 seasons. The villain of the story is Clark. I want to despise her, but I can't muster the feeling. Her otherworldliness is just too overwhelming. I've been sucked in by the buzzer beaters against Indiana and Michigan State, the impossible-seeming assists, the dethroning of South Carolina, the exhilaration of viewership numbers that show that while interest in Clark is soaring, interest in the sport as a whole is jumping too. I can't take seriously the lame claims that there's something objectionable about her on-court demeanor. Clark is great, and I love watching her play. There won't be any Hawkeye gear, including Clark's, entering our house anytime soon. My grimaces haven't gone away, but she's a rival I can't help but applaud. And again, that was by Lucas Grunmeyer, the Register's opinion editor.
And turning now letters to the editor. Why is Lisa Bluder paid so little? Fran McCaffrey is a pretty good coach who makes over $3 million a year. Lisa Bluder is a great coach who makes less than half of that. While we're enjoying the successes of Caitlin Clark and her team this season, a performance very similar to last year, Iowa, particularly the University of Iowa, needs to do better for Bluder. You know, a little fairness. And that is from Rick Chapman of Des Moines. This next letter is from Judith Fohl, that is spelled capital P-F-O-H-L, in Iowa City. Don't blame school boards. Don't blame the local school boards for closing schools, larger class sizes, or loss of teachers. State school funding is reduced and more siphoned off with student vouchers to private schools that choose the students they want and have no oversight. Blame yourself if you voted Republican, and it will only get worse as the state taxes become only charged for what you spend to survive, not based upon wealth and ability to help others. That from Judith Fohl of Iowa City. This next from Kevin Lair of Winterset. Trump deserves no credit on peace, drugs, public health. The writer of the March 31 letter, another term of Biden chaos will devastate America, misses the mark by echoing conservative media and MAGA talking points. Too many on the right are suffering from selective amnesia during the past administration, including botching our response to COVID-19 and deliberately misleading the public on the dangerous reality we faced. Coming out of the pandemic under President Joe Biden, the U.S. has done better than all its international contemporaries in fostering record employment and the return to economic opportunity for challenges ahead. Biden did what was long overdue and avoided by past administrations by getting us out of Afghanistan. The past administration not only coddled dictators such as Vladimir Putin, but continues to applaud and capitulate to aggression toward our allies, peace and democracy. Giving Donald Trump credit on that front is like hiring a failed arsonist to be on the fire department. Our substance abuse issues are hardly new. I was around for the war on drugs and Just Say No, and certainly for the fact that fentanyl deaths spiked during Trump administration. However, this is just more selective amnesia that many on the right hope we will all suffer from this November. That from Kevin Lair of Winterset. This next is from Alan Bonini of Urbandale. Misplaced fear of regulation. Iowans need to free themselves from the perception that they must concede all power to agriculture by not imposing any burdensome regulations on ag, that ag will disappear from the state and its future will be bleak if it is regulated. It is a false premise. The reality is ag land is a fixed asset and demand for farmland far outstrips supply. This gross imbalance in the supply-demand curve argues that any regulations to protect the greater public interest in a healthy environment will not drive ag out of Iowa. It has no better place to go. Farmers are not going to stop farming. They are not going to pack up their tractors and move to another state. They will not give up the opportunity to produce high yields. If they do, the supply-demand imbalance will cause someone else to step in and fill the void. Iowa prime farmland cannot be exported to another state, although it can continue to be washed down to the Gulf of Mexico. So there is no need to fear that common sense regulation of ag will drive ag out of the state. Again from Alan Bonini of Urbandale. And this last one doesn't have an author. Share your feelings on Caitlin Clark. Caitlin Clark's ability on the basketball court has helped earn her worldwide fame. We want to hear from readers about their thoughts on the Iowa Hawkeyes' run to a second consecutive Final Four. Email letters at dmreg.com and try to stay below 200 words. Include your name and city of residence.
Okay, we're going to turn to the sports section, and I'm going to start with what is on TV today. In the NHL at 7 p.m. this evening on ESPN Plus and Hulu, we have St. Louis at Nashville. At 9:30 p.m., after that game, we have the LA Kings at San Jose. In NBA basketball, this evening at 6:30 p.m. on TNT, Sacramento is at the New York Knicks. At 9 p.m. on TNT, Denver at the LA Clippers. In men's college basketball, we have one game this evening at 6 p.m. on ESPN, Seton Hall versus Indiana State. And in Major League Baseball, we have a game on ESPN Plus at 3:05 this afternoon, Pittsburgh at Washington. At 3:10 on the Major League Baseball Network, we have Cleveland at Minnesota. At 3:15 p.m., we have on the Major League Baseball Network, Miami at St. Louis. Not sure how they do that, two games at once, but at 6:40 p.m., we have Chicago White Sox at Kansas City, also at the on the MLBN network. In soccer, the English Premier League at 1:30 on Peacock, we have Sheffield United at Liverpool, and at 2:15 this afternoon on USA NBCU, we have Manchester United at Chelsea. And now when we go to the front page, we've got a big picture of the Iowa Cubs Principal Park Stadium. It says, Iowa Cubs home opener. Grounds crew members prepare the field at Principal Park before Tuesday's Iowa Cubs home opener. The Cubs defeated the Toledo Mud Hens 5-4 in 10 innings. And it's got a picture down below of Iowa Cub players Daniel Palencia warming up as members of the grounds crew prepare the field before Tuesday's home opener at Principal Park. Now we have an article. Hawkeyes star Clark repeats as Naismith Trophy winner. This is by Dargan Southard out of Cleveland. After Caitlin Clark swept the Women's Basketball Player of the Year awards last season, doing the same in her senior year would require an even stronger performance. That's just how repeat bids work, full of extra criticism and dissection at every turn. Clark never gave any of it a chance to matter. back at the Final Four, the second consecutive year after guiding Iowa through an unprecedented women's basketball season, the Hawkeye star kicked off the week in Cleveland by repeating as the Naismith Trophy winner. The honor officially came Wednesday during a ceremony at the KeyBank Club inside Cleveland Browns Stadium. Although it was obvious much sooner that Clark would be making the Player of the Year rounds again. That's impressive enough in any year, but especially given who the other finalists were alongside Clark this season. She beat out Stanford's Cameron Brink, USC's Juju Watkins, and UConn's Paige Buchers, the latter getting a crack at Clark and Iowa Friday evening in the Final Four. All three could have been easy Player of the Year choices in many other seasons, but Clark's dominance atop the sport grows each time she takes the floor. Just when it seemed there was no more space for greatness after Iowa's homegrown star delivered on her dream and led the Hawkeyes to their first Final Four in 30 years, Clark found a way to cram more heroics inside an already overflowing profile. Nearly every stat increased from Clark's junior year to senior. Points per game, 27.8 to 32. Assists per game, 8.6 to 9. And rebounds per game, 7.1 to 7.3, somehow all improved from what was already elite. Before taking the floor at Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse Friday night, Clark already has 128 more points than last year in one fewer game, 1,055 to 1,183. Pouncing on every chance to get even a little better is why Clark is in her own category on so many levels. She's managed to turn monumental milestones into casual footnotes, requiring something as significant as scoring more points than any other Division I basketball player, man or woman, to pause and reflect. This year, Clark also set top marks for most single-season points and three-pointers in Division I women's history, while also becoming the first Division I women's player to have back-to-back 1,000-point campaigns. This list goes on and on, with Clark often passing up some of the sport's proudest names. Wednesday's announcement makes Clark the Naismith's first repeat winner since UConn's Brianna Stewart won three straight from 2014 to 2016. Only six others, Brittany Griner, 2012 to 13, Simone Augustus, 2005 to 2006, and Diana Taurasi, 2003 to 2004, Chamique Holdsclaw, 1998-99, Dawn Staley, 1991-92, and Cheryl Miller, 1984-1986, have ever won back-to-back Naismiths since it was first awarded in 1983. This article again was by Dugard Southard, a sports trending reporter who covers Iowa athletics for the Des Moines Register and HawkCentral.com. And we have time for couple little briefs here. LSU star Reese declares for WNBA draft. Angel Reese of LSU said Wednesday she is declaring for the WNBA draft. Reese announced her decision to Vogue magazine in an interview and via a social media post. She's expected to be a top 10 pick in the April 15th draft. "I've done everything I wanted to in college," Reese said. "I've won a national championship. I've gotten Southeastern Conference Player of the Year. I've been an All-American. My ultimate goal is to be a pro and to be one of the greatest basketball players to play ever. I feel like I'm ready." And now we're going to turn to Dear Abby with Dorothy.
Okay, now we go to Dear Abby. Co-worker, friend becomes outlet for others' trauma. Dear Abby, it seems I am a human landfill into which people dump their trauma. I'm not sure how this happened. It started 3 years ago when an estranged friend called me and talked for more than an hour about what had led to him getting fired from his job. I was touched that he had reached out, and I expected us to resume our friendship, but he wasn't interested in much more communication. Later, a work acquaintance invited me to lunch and began unloading the awful trauma she had endured 40 years ago. It was a one-way conversation, with not even enough pause for me to politely reaffirm what was being said. We never spoke after that because I left the company. Now, a new coworker I haven't made any personal connection with calls me a few times a week to trauma dump. I try to change the subject, but her stories of abuse and peril never stop. In fact, I can put her on speakerphone while I loudly go about my business at home, and she'll continue talking. When she finally has had enough, she then abruptly ends the call. I finally decided I'm done answering her calls. What can I do to ensure that I am no longer seen as the trauma landfill? And that is from Done With It in Pennsylvania. Abby says, Dear Done, this keeps happening because you are a caring, empathetic, and polite person who has the patience to allow these people to dump on you. The next time it starts to happen, say this, quote, This must have been terrible, but I am not equipped to advise you about it. This is something that should be addressed by talking to a therapist, end quote. After that, be less available. The next letter is, Dear Abby, Last year, a dear friend was attacked by dogs and killed. My family enjoys hiking on public trails. Lately, however, our walks have not been enjoyable. I become nervous and very upset whenever I encounter dogs off-leash. I usually end up expressing my fear and asking the owner to put their dogs on a leash. My 16-year-old daughter is not comfortable when I do this. Her view is that the owners have trained their dogs well enough to be off-leash. I disagree. I tell her that animals are unpredictable, and I am speaking out because my friend was killed by dogs. Please help us understand the best way to handle this situation, which ends up in a conflict. And that is from Walking Scared in Wisconsin. Abby replies, Dear Walking, Your daughter's view is naive. Although the majority of dog owners are responsible and socialize and train their pets, not all of them do so, and the result can be tragic. Your friend's death is an example. When your daughter decides to hike, she should always have someone with her and carry pepper spray or gel to ward off an attack, not only by canines, but also humans. As for you, you might be better off emotionally if, for the time being, you get your cardio exercise on a treadmill, in a gym, or at home.
Okay, if we had time for a couple little short briefs from the 50 states section. In Iowa, Des Moines, Iowa House lawmakers have approved a plan to overhaul the state's mental health and disability service systems, sending one of Governor Kim Reynolds' priority pieces of legislation to the Senate. In Wisconsin, out of Madison, Governor Tony Evers vetoed a bill that would have banned transgender and gender nonconforming youths from participating on school athletic teams that align with their gender identity. And in Minnesota, out of St. Cloud, Minnesota State has named two finalists for the interim president of St. Cloud State University. The Board of Trustees of the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities is expected to consider Chancellor Scott Olson's recommendation at its April 17th meeting. And in Nebraska, the Lee G. Simmons Wildlife Safari Park is set to debut a new Ice Age-themed exhibit in May, the Omaha World Herald reported. And that brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today. I'm Teresa Whitaker, and my partner at the microphone has been Dorothy Hockenberg. Earlier, you heard Linda Lundgren and Twyla Glenn. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.